Today's episode of the Gestalt Education Show is brought to you by three of our favorite sponsors, Human Locomotion, Core 360 Bell, and Dynamic Disc Designs. All the information can be found below. By now, you have definitely heard us talk about them, so check out the show notes, click the links, use the codes, and make sure you support our favorite people. As always, we got a great episode lined up for you today, and thanks for tuning in. All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of the Gestalt Education Show. Today we are back on Zoom, Brett, and we are sitting down with one of the world's most recognizable researchers in the world of chiropractic, especially in the last 10 years. And so Dr. Anders Eklund, you're a legend because one of the things that we've talked a lot about on this podcast is maintenance care and how, you know, it sometimes comes off as a dirty word in the realm of chiropractic. But what your research has shown is that there's actually evidence for it, number one. And number two, there's giant efficacy for checking up with our patients. And so can you maybe just kind of walk us through how you got involved with research to start? And then we'll kind of start breaking down some of your research and we'll get into some of the other things. Because you have a big clinical background as well before you got into research.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for asking me to come on your podcast. Really excited to share my experiences and thoughts and what we've found in our research. So I graduated 2002. I had no thought of going into research at all. It wasn't on the map at all. But then I spent a few years in clinical practice and I started having these questions that I didn't get answered by taking courses. How does it all fit together? What does it mean? What do I do for this patient? And the courses I took, there were lots of theories. Some of them were loosely rooted in science and some of them were, rooted in other stuff. I was frustrated. So I got dragged into participating in a clinical research network where I was, as a clinician, helped gather information in research trials. And parallel to that, we could take part in the actual design of the projects and how it was analyzed and communicated. And that sparked my interest. And then as things turned out, I applied for a PhD position in 2012. And then I've been doing research since. Not in periods, it's been 100% research, but it's been going up and down in terms of how I've managed to still keep a practice. So at the moment, I'm one day a week in doing research and 4 days a week in clinic. And it depends on grants we have and money coming in and projects that are ongoing. So it's been going from like one day a week to 100% and up and down depending on the projects that we've gone.
Dr. Eklund, I always tell a story because we're in a small town here in the middle of the United States in Missouri. And, you know, I thought that I was helping patients. And then I saw these patients out in my small town, and these patients that I thought that I had helped had ended up doing, you know, some other treatment or something like that. Did you have a similar story which made you so passionate about maintenance care? Because I feel like a lot of us who are a little bit older, I'm about your age, I think, as far as when I graduated, you think you're fixing everybody in 2 and 3 visits. And then like you start to see some of your failures and then you kind of realize that perhaps you didn't manage them in the long term as good as you could have.
Yeah. For sure. That was one aspect of it that I didn't feel I was doing good with my patients. They were coming back or going to see other people. And then on the other side, there were these clinic management companies advising on how to set up these long treatment plans and long treatment programs. And there was this dichotomy in terms of how we should be managing our patients. Either it was the science-based group who said, well, you know, it's a short intervention and then you leave the patient alone as soon as you can. And then there was the other one, which was more or less, you know, you have them come back for the rest of their life. That's what chiropractic is. That's the foundation of it. And I was torn in between thinking, you know, I can't reconciliate with either of these really. There is something to this long-term management and supporting patients over time, but who should I be supporting? in the beginning, I thought it was the ones that I could save, the healthy ones, the ones that didn't have that much problems, that we were actually preventing something to occur. In our research today, we would call them adaptive copers. And we've found that they weren't actually the ones that we should be focusing on. In fact, I was probably making them worse in terms of pain. And the ones that I felt I wasn't helping, the dysfunctional ones, the ones that were really struggling with pain, those are the ones that seem to do extremely well with this long-term management strategy that we've called maintenance care. So it was I was using the concept as such, but I didn't really know how and why, and that really sparked my interest in it. And I was really thrilled to then get on a PhD project that had that as the main focus, to develop and understand and yeah, to scrutinize the procedure.
Good. And what have you learned about the trajectory of low back pain, Andreas? Is it there's multiple reoccurrence that need to be managed, or you know, what would be your and I know there's like different classifications between acute, subacute, chronic, of course, but I mean, what are some big take-home messages that you're learning about people with low back pain over the long term?
Well, one of the things is their psychological profile, or the way they perceive their pain and behave around it, is crucial. Understanding that and being able to pick up the subtle cues or the not so subtle cues when it comes to understanding that field is crucial to understanding the long-term trajectory and management of these patients. But also that pain trajectories are individual. They're fairly stable, but they're individual. So by understanding the trajectory of a single patient for the past year, you can predict the trajectory for the coming year. So they're stable over a fairly short period of time. So when you see them as a clinician, you can be pretty certain that if you spend enough time understanding what they've experienced the past year, you could understand what they're about to experience the coming year. And that patients are really different, that some have the last 10 years of trajectory research have shown that we have a number of different clusters of patients where you have static pain levels, pain going up and down, those that are getting better. And patients, when you look at their individual trajectories, they're very, very different. So I think what I've learned is to understand the individual. And that really ties into our research. If you spend time understanding what the patient is experiencing right now in relation to their pain and what they have experienced, then you're very well equipped to also understand what they're probably going to be challenged with.
Mm-hmm. How do we reconcile research that's looking at a broad group, such as, you know, meta-analysis, things like that, to then the patient that's right in front of us, or N equals one, if that makes sense? So what you're talking about there with the, you know, understanding the person in front of you, what can we, you know, extrapolate from the research that you've done to then kind of key it into that one person individually?
Well, that is the real clinical skill, isn't it? Like the triad of evidence-based practice or evidence-informed practice, where we have the competence and skill of the clinicians and their qualifications and techniques or available interventions, the best available evidence, and the patient's preferences. And I think the skilled clinician is someone who is very well equipped at dealing with those three aspects for every single patient. They understand their signs, they know what is recommended, they have tools that are relevant for the group of people they meet, and they're very attentive to what their patients have experienced before and expect and appreciate. So I think that's the core skill. If I'd say that the one skill that I've been made me a better clinician has been the ability to be good at those three aspects when it comes to meeting my patients.
And how much does the quality of the chiropractic care matter? Meaning, you know, there's an ongoing debate that rages on about what are the best techniques, what are, you know, the best ways to combine our techniques together. So in your research, how do you start to, you know, ferret out what those different ideas potentially could be? Or is it really, I hate to say this, but is it not making that big of a difference on what actually is getting done in the chiropractic treatments?
Well, I think yes and no. When you look at it from a group level, there seems to be very little difference in terms of what we do, in terms of the different interventions, or even within just the field of manual therapy, that the effect sizes are fairly small and about the same across the board. I think the skill comes down to understanding what the pay this particular patient prefers and expects. We did a project where we looked at expectations as an outcome of the early clinical results, and we found that the actual expectations of the patients were crucial. They were the most important predictor of treatment outcomes at the fourth visit. And that was they were much stronger than psychological profile and the other baseline predictors that we could address. So understanding expectations is, I think, is crucial. And expectations is not only, some would say, it's a placebo, but I don't think so. Expectations is about the patient referring to what they have experienced in their past, what treatments were effective for me, what did I appreciate, and what am I what does my thought world look like, what do I think is actually working. And when they put that together, it becomes a an expectation into what. So if you can understand that and align with that, with a number of treatment methods in hand, I think you can be very effective in managing that individual. So I think more has to do with that, our ability to align with patients and choosing the right interventions, relating it to the of course the condition, but also with patient expectations.
And then how do you play in both worlds of self-efficacy and maintenance? Because I feel like we try really hard in our practice here to be able to play in both of those worlds to where we don't really feel like our patients are dependent on this, but we still, have them as the locus of control. We're having them doing home care. So what would you say to that?
Well, let me just recap the research that we've done, and I think we'll fall right into that because that's the very essence of this. I mean, the take-home message of it. So back in 2012, this project started off. It was a large randomized clinical trial, the first one of its kind to look at the effectiveness and cost effectiveness of maintenance care. But prior to that trial, we'd done probably get another 10 different papers on the content of maintenance care, the indications for it, and a number of different projects just to lay down the groundwork of understanding how do chiropractors practice. What is the method of the madness? How do we choose patients and what goes on in the different offices? And based on that information, we then designed this trial, a pragmatic trial. So we weren't looking at specific techniques or specific items of what they did, but the chiropractic package as a whole. And what we'd learned from the other papers that were written was that this is very similar. Most chiropractors have a similar idea about why they do it, how they do it, and what they do when they see the patient. And then they have different techniques, and perhaps the flavor of it is different. But the overall content is very, very similar, except for a few exceptions who of those who do never do maintenance care and those who always do maintenance care. So we designed the project around that. We followed patients for 12 months. First, we treated them in an initial trial, like you would in the clinic. They come in, you provide whatever care you think is appropriate, they get better. And once they're at the point where you would say, "Thank you so much for visiting me, come back when you have another problem," or "Let's put you on a maintenance care schedule," that's when the trial started. And then we followed them for 12 months. We collected data weekly with SMS. So we have an extremely robust and high frequency data on their pain over those 12 months. And then we collected data in the beginning and at the end of the trial. And what we found then was that the patients who got the maintenance care protocol compared to come back and see me as you would like, they were a little bit better. On average, 10 to 12 days less pain. And they had a little bit more visits, about two visits, 5 to 7. So the results weren't earth shaking. It wasn't, it was a bit difficult to understand. It says if we like squeeze this amount of days out on 12 months, it's less than half a day a week. Would that be relevant to patients? Well, we didn't really know. The chiropractic world knew. They pushed this paper and it was all over. Everyone loved it. And I spent months responding on social media about this. And it was sort of the proof of that chiropractic and Ains care worked. And I saw people talking about this. Some made very strange references to the paper. Some made very correct ones. It was wonderful and very strange. we then went on to look at a subgroup. So when we started up the project, we had a background idea that, you know, maybe psychological subgroups might modify the effect, that certain subgroups are more have more benefit from care. So we used an instrument that divided patients up into three different psychological subgroups: adaptive copers, the ones that are doing really well, that doesn't experience that much, that high pain severity. They don't have that much interference. They don't have that much affective distress. They manage their pain well. They have a high degree of control in their life. They don't need a lot of support to manage their pain. And then we have the other group on the other side, the dysfunctional ones who don't manage their pain well. They need a lot of support, high interference, high pain severity, high affective distress. Stress, individuals that are struggling to cope with their pain. These are also the ones with a high risk of long-term sick leave and the ones that end up costing society a whole lot. And then we have sort of a...
How did you subgroup them? Like, how did you know which group people were in?
So we used a complex screening instrument called the West Haven Yale Multidimensional Pain Inventory, or short MPI. It's been used since the 80s, a super robust instrument that's been used for a number of different pain conditions, but it's just useless for clinical practice because it's long, about over 30 questions, I think 36 questions, and you need statistical software to generate these subgroups. So it's just still not feasible for clinical practice. But for research purposes, it's been used widely, and we can compare our data to lots of other different populations and say, you know, what are our chiropractic patients like? We've actually published a paper on that as well. But that was the basis of that analysis. And what we found then was that when we gave maintenance care to the adaptive copers, the one that did really well, they actually had more pain, on average 10 more days with pain for that 12-month period. They also had 4 more visits. So they got more treatment and they had more pain. So it seemed like that was not a very smart idea for that group, saying to them, you know, come back when you need me. You're managing fine on your own, that will be the good choice. For the dysfunctional group, there was a completely different picture. They had almost a month the difference, so 30 days less pain compared to the other group, and they had equal number of visits. So it was much better and less and similar cost as to if you'd ask them to come back.
Is it 30 days in a calendar year? Is that?
Yeah. So, and what we also looked at was how did this distribute? So we found that the episodes were less acute when they had relapses. The periods in between were longer, about 10 weeks longer compared to the other group. So it seemed to be a really significant difference for the dysfunctional group subgroup. And the most interesting bit was it didn't actually require more care. It was just that framework of seeing patients on a regular basis seemed to be so much better. And now I'm getting back to your question before that. So I think part of maintenance care is setting up a psychological framework for patients to manage their pain in, knowing that they have a time booked with you in X amount of weeks ahead of time, allows them perhaps to challenge fear avoidance behaviors, faulty thought patterns, do exercises that they might not be worried about doing before. So I think it has a lot to do with that, that there is a psychological framework, because it doesn't seem to be a difference in terms of the frequency. Possibly and probably it has to do when the treatment occurs. So in the maintenance care group, they got pain when they didn't have that much pain, whereas the other group got pain, treatment when they had a lot of pain. So it could be with the timing that we're timing them correctly, so that we're addressing nociception early on in a remission in a relapse, or it could be that we're developing this psychological framework to help them operate within. So I don't think it's about taking away self-efficacy. I think maintenance care is about supporting them in gaining self-efficacy by creating a safety net where you can coach them over time into becoming more self-efficacy. And possibly maintenance care is about shifting someone from that dysfunctional profile into that adaptive coper. And once when they are, I don't think we need to do that anymore. So those would be like the broad findings of the program so far.
Oh, that was perfect. So what would, either through your research or in your own opinion right now, what do you think the maintenance program should look like as far as how often do you feel like we should be checking in with the patients?
Well, that would be a wonderful thing if I had something to tell you there. I know what chiropractors have done previously. That's the only thing we know, that most chiropractors see their patients in about a 1 to 3 month interval. And the mean is about 2 months. So it seems you have them in more frequently. You then taper off slowly a few weeks in between. You then perhaps a month and then two and then three. And some would even consider maybe schedule them 6 months or 12 months down the line. But I think somewhere 1 to 3 months seems to be the most common way of scheduling. Is it the best? I don't know. We haven't tested that. Mm-hmm. That would be a super interesting project to see, you know, should we see them often? More often or more seldom? Is it enough with a phone call? I don't know. There are so many interesting questions to still.
Sorry to interrupt this episode, guys. Hope you're enjoying it. Real quick, we have an amazing, amazing opportunity. The DNS World Congress is coming to Chesterfield, Missouri this June 14th through the 16th, 2024. If you guys attended our NDS or our Neurodynamics Congress, you know that this is something that's very close to Brett and I's heart, something that we are going to keep doing and keep doing and keep doing. So this year's Congress is all about DNS, dynamic neuromuscular stabilization. This is literally like looking into the ocean, as Brett says. This is the lens that we look through each and every one of our patients with. And this is going to be an amazing opportunity because Pavel is back in town. So the originator, the creator of DNS, Pavel Kolash, is coming to the stage for the first time in 5 or 6 years. I don't even know how long it's been. He's bringing along with him Elena Kobosova, which is literally the backbone of DNS. She's one of the most underrated neurologists in the world. So we're super excited to hear from her. Marcella Safarova, if you haven't heard her speak, she is literally the queen of pediatrics and musculoskeletal health. We also are going to have almost every single U.S. instructor at the Congress who's going to be speaking. It's going to include demos, lectures, hands-on. We're going to have, as always, a get-together afterwards with your chance to talk to these guys face-to-face and have a couple drinks with them. This is going to be a great, great opportunity. There's also, it's a great price too, especially for students. It's only $4.99. So be sure to use the code DNSstudent to get your discount on that. For more information or if you have questions, go to gestaltedu.com/DNS-Congress. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
Can you speak on maybe and I know it's going to be different in different parts of the world, but the cost savings that would be involved with a maintenance program? Because I think when people first look at maintenance care, they have an opinion in their mind that it's costing the healthcare system more money. But now it seems like that actually it would be costing the healthcare system a lot of money if it's saving downstream, more expedited medical treatment.
Yeah, so we've actually done a cost-effectiveness analysis of this. It's not published yet for a number of reasons, but what we've found was that obviously if something it requires equal amount of treatment, but is more effective, it's a cost-effective treatment at that point. But what is more interesting is that having pain is not only associated with suffering, it's also associated with cost. And one of the things we measured in our trial is production loss or reduced ability to work. So patients were asked in the end to rate how much they were affected in terms of their ability to be producing at work or doing their normal chores at work. So with that, we've been able to calculate put a number on the consequences of pain in our trial. So we've been able to mimic the potential costs of pain in this cost effectiveness analysis in sort of you usually call it a simulation. Because cost effectiveness is usually a simulation of the real world. You use what you have to try to simulate what it's like in the real world. So that's a very exciting paper when it comes out. It'll be very influential in this field. I don't have any figures in my head right now, but it certainly shows that if we provide maintenance care for the dysfunctional patients, we are likely to be very cost effective
mm-hmm.
and what sa- about saving the- society money.
Dr. Eklund, I heard you on a podcast. I know that you published a paper regarding this, of the thought that in these people that are not able to cope, low back pain is more about management in some of these cases rather than having an end goal of not having low back pain again for the rest of your life.
And I think that, fixing, not fixing.
Right. Yeah. And so I think that's something we share. Can you kind of speak on that as well? You know, we kind of have it as our opinion that we're chasing function. And so, yes, pain is important because that's why our patients are coming to see us. However, if we don't change some of the reasons that they've been there, that could be the part of it. But I'd also just wanted your opinion on low back pain, maybe not being episodic, maybe being more in a chronic likelihood.
Yeah, I think you're hitting it right on the head. Chasing pain is probably not a viable strategy to help these patients manage it long term, but rather setting functional goals. As chiropractors, we like to measure things biologically or physiologically and set those as physical goals. But there's very little research to say that those actually change the quality of life. And I think we should be doing that. We should be looking at function, physical function. But more importantly, I think we should be setting patient-specific goals. And that was really one of the ideas behind developing this instrument that we're testing now in Canada, the Maintain instrument. So the idea behind the Maintain instrument is that we have a short version of the MPI instrument. So you have 10 questions, and these 10 questions capture these five dimensions: pain severity, interference, effective distress, support, and life control. And one, you get a score, an overall score of psychological distress. So you know if this patient is likely to be a dysfunctional patient and a good candidate for long-term management, and that could be maintenance care. But you also get these scales on these specific dimensions indicating where the patient scores high. So if they score really high on interference, well, that cues you into asking questions about interference. So you could then go ahead and say, so when I've looked at this this instrument that you scored, we can see that you score really high on interference. Could you tell me more about that? And then the patient then goes into detail. Well, it's about me not being able to sleep, or I'm unable to play with my kids, or I can't do golf, and so on and so on. And then we use that information in another instrument called the patient-specific functional scale, which is like an NRS scale. 0 to 10, but we use that specific behavior that is challenging for the patient to estimate their level of how they're affected or unable to do it. So it could be, well, I can't sleep. I wake up 4 times a night because of my pain and I have to move around. So how would you then rate it on this 0 to 10 scale? How much are you your sleep affected by your pain? And they would say maybe an 8, and then we would use that patient-specific functional goal as one of the outcomes that we strive to improve for the patient over time. And then you might set 5, 6, 7 of these goals, and then those would be form the basis of your treatment plan, and your treatment strategies would be aiming to specifically address these things. It would, of course, be what we do as chiropractors, but it could be other things. If we see that perhaps affective distress is high, they're emotionally not managing their pain well, there's a lot of worry and fear, you might want to focus more on discussing pain signs with them, talking about beliefs and helping them guide into more rational beliefs about their pain, etc. Or it might be support. They might be in extreme need of support in their surroundings. So you can ask them or perhaps co-manage it with a occupational therapist in looking at how can we reduce the stress on the environment around you by reducing the need for support by self-management through different ways. So that's really the idea with this instrument, that not only do we get this idea of who is suitable for maintenance care, who's not, who has a high level of distress, but we get these dimensions of psychological distress that we can pick up on and then home in then on the different areas that the patient themselves has indicated, this is important to me. This is why I come to see you. This is why my life is not good. And then use that to develop outcomes in your treatment plan and have that as another way of assessing the outcome of what you do. So I think that is... Yeah. That is where a lot of the research is going in terms of how we long-term manage pain. It's about asking the patient what is not working, set goals according to that, and then help them to achieve those goals rather than just chasing pain, like you were saying.
And are there parameters out of, like, an exit strategy out of the maintenance program in itself, or is the maintenance program just kind of like open-ended with kind of like, I hate to say into infinity, but... Is there an endpoint to it, or what's your thoughts on that?
We're not there yet. I would expect there to be. I hope there is. Like I was mentioning before, when you can see that transition from that dysfunctional patient to the adaptive coper, I don't think maintenance care is a viable strategy or an appropriate one. And perhaps using patient-specific functional goals, that is one way of assessing, are they managing well over time? Or are we developing new issues? Or are we just sorting these out and the patient's self-efficacy improves? And that at some point you feel, you don't need me. There's no point in you coming to see me. I don't need to support you in this anymore. You're doing wonderfully well on your own. And then leaving them alone. I think that should be the plan. When we do that, we don't have answers for that yet. But I think probably most clinicians who have some experience working with this would have an idea. If your focus is on the patient and their specific needs, and you find that you're not contributing anymore and the patient's doing well, then I think we should be hands off.
Have you guys found that following up with the patients is more challenging the more time that you allow in between visits? Because what we've learned is if you go beyond once a month, then they can be less compliant just simply because they forget, not out of disrespect. You know, if you're wanting to check up on a patient quarterly, so every 3 months, sometimes they're more likely to forget about that appointment than if it was like a tighter follow-up time.
Well, we haven't looked at that, but that's reasonable for sure.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on what type of compliance you have. Is it a very challenging exercise strategy that you need to coach them and support them in that is neither interesting for the patient or very difficult? Then you're going to have to see them, I guess, a lot more often to keep that motivation alive. But if it's something that they really enjoy, are really happy about doing, don't want to leave out of their life and that they know and handle really well, then perhaps you don't need to coach them as much in that sense. Or they might not need the manual therapy part of maintenance care as much because the challenges are in certain areas. So I don't know. I don't have any good questions there. I don't have any good answers. You have good questions. I don't have any good answers.
What about, the thought is, and we're both, are you familiar with the McKinsey Institute?
Yeah.
So we're both certified in McKinsey, which is all about self-efficacy. And what about, there's just certain patients that aren't going to do home exercise. They just, for some reason, they're just not going to do it. How do you get around the fact that, we have the evidence-based group that is telling us, well, we just need to show them home exercises, but those of us who are out in the wild know that there's a subgroup of people that just aren't going to do these home exercises. So how do we wrestle with all these thoughts?
That's the big thing. And I think there is some exciting research being done, being planned and being done on these, how we can introduce modern behavioral psychology and behavioral change techniques into how we work with patients, as in chiros and physios. But I think that's it's a constant issue, isn't it? Because my clinic, I run two clinic with two colleagues that are multidisciplinary. We're 60% of what we do is physiotherapy, and about 20% is chiropractic, and then we have occupational therapists and dietitians. And so over the two clinics, we're about 50 clinicians working together in teams. And this is the constant discussion. You know, how do we get people to do the exercises? You know, we have them come in and train in our gyms and under supervision, and then they gradually become less and less supervised, and then eventually transition into their own gyms or into their own home exercise program. But keeping patients on these routines is superbly challenging, extremely challenging for all of us. And we don't have any great answers to it. But I think that there's a lot to learn from the field of psychology. And I think there's some great stuff coming in the future on that, and creating toolkits for us as clinicians to implement in our clinic to help motivate and create behavior change with our patients.
Well, I think sometimes the behavior change needs to be with the clinicians, because I'm sure you found that on your team, certain people are better than other people on your team on getting their patients to check back up with them.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And some are more interested in actually creating sustainable change than others. Some people just want to do their job and get on with it and get with the next patient. But having that genuine interest in changing people's behavior is quite rare.
Yeah. Well, let's maybe change gears just a little bit. So, you know, for us out in the wild, Dr. Eglin, how do you suggest, or how do you see it? How do you see clinicians being involved with research, number one, and how do we keep up on the research that's coming out? It seems like every single day, if you're on Twitter, yeah, you're on ResearchGate or something like that, like there's just so much. How do we disseminate, number one, what's good research, and then number two, how to actually apply it?
Well, you know, this is a challenge for everyone. This is a challenge for researchers. I mean, me as a researcher, I try to stay updated in my field. Mm-hmm. But it's by no means can I stay updated in the whole field of musculoskeletal medicine. There's so much research coming out from left to right. So keeping updated is tough. I think one way of doing it is getting research literacy, understanding how to read a paper. That would be the basis. You have to understand how to gauge information. Is this good? Is this bad research? Mm-hmm. Understand where are the most likely sources of good research. It's like systematic reviews, meta-analyses, and what are the challenges with those? As in, you know, what is it I can't understand from that, and how should I and cannot trust that? So just like basic research literacy is, I think, super important. I think every chiropractic professional organization should have like ongoing journal clubs, perhaps, or at least seminars or courses for reading research. Most chiropractic programs have that, but most chiropractors don't have that as a main interest, I'd say. So I think that getting research literacy. Katie was talking about it on your podcast as well. There are now some excellent resources to get research really easy, simply like the I lose words. The Canadian
Sean Thistle's group.
Yeah, Sean Thistle's group. Wonderful stuff. They do such amazing summaries of research and putting it together in packages that is really easily digestible in different formats that are easily to listen to. Listening to podcasts like you guys who approach research in a really approachable way, creating interest and generating information. I think those are all superbly great ways of getting a hold of research. But I think the most important thing is the way I got into it. See if you can get involved in a practice-based research network. Help generate research, because that is the best data that we can possibly have. If we can get data from offices in clinical trials, that is extremely valuable to us as researchers and to our patients. So if you have the chance, engage yourself in clinical research, help collect data. And if that's interesting to you, take it a step further. See if you can be part of organizing new trials, perhaps not as a researcher, but as a co-author. We have a fellow in Canada who's a clinician, not a researcher. He's not planning to be a researcher, but he's been extremely involved in this project that we're running now in Canada, learning loads and also getting to answer some of the research questions that he has without having to jump into it. So there are different levels where you can interact and engage with research. And then, of course, if you can and if you want, you know, see if you can team up with someone and get a PhD. We need more PhDs. We need more researchers. We need more people engaging and answering all these wonderfully interesting questions that we have in this field that is just, you know, it's the best time to be in the field of manual therapy and exercise therapy. The guidelines, everything is pointing in our direction. Being a researcher in this field and a therapist in this field is perfect. So I think there's, whether you're interested in clinical work or research, that the field we're in is really in where things are going.
You think, kind of in closing, Andreas, it'd be fair to think of what you and I are doing as chiropractors is no different than a cardiologist. So somebody has like a heart problem, you don't go to the cardiologist one time. From that point forward, there requires management. So maybe chiropractors aren't quite as good at fixing things as we originally thought that we were. And some of these musculoskeletal cases just basically need to be maintained.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a heavy load on someone's shoulders to be the fixer of things when it comes to chronic conditions. So getting our new graduates to think that they're supposed to fix people's backs coming out of school, that's setting up them for failure. I think this idea that we need to become good at helping people manage things, first line would be self-manage things. And if that's not possible, then we should be supporting them in that process with our skills and our procedures. So certainly that's the way to go. The people that don't need management, probably don't need us. So the ones that need management, that they should be managed and not fixed, I think, if we can't fix them.
Yeah,
right.
No, that's for awesome. A lot of people.
Love that. Well, Dr. Eklund, can you maybe close with, obviously you talked about this big pilot you got going on in Canada, but what are some other things ongoing right now in your world of research, and what are some things you're excited about coming forward?
Well, I'm excited about some of my colleagues in Denmark and in the US and Australia are doing some really amazing research on adolescents and children in trying to understand the development of spinal pain and understanding the preventive measures that can be done. It's not my field, but I'm super excited about where this is going and what we can learn from that. And I think just overall, I'm super excited about the research community, the chiropractic research community. It's not a huge group. We need to be more, but there's such a lovely and friendly and supportive group, and there's so much exciting stuff going on around in the world. Mm-hmm. And some of the hot spots around the world are really producing some amazing research. So I'm excited about the future of chiropractic and research and musculoskeletal care.
Love that.
Can I finish with one more question? So kind of the knock, and we're definitely more on the evidence-based camp, obviously, and what we believe and do. But so the knock is always that, well, I had to keep coming back to my chiropractor. I think that's what we all struggle with on this idea. So how do you think the people that are out in practice right now make it more digestible to their patients and to the world about this whole idea of maintenance? Like, what are some of the things that they should be saying and things like that?
Great question.
Well, I think that first of all, they shouldn't be scared if someone says psychology. We're not psychologists. I appreciate that. But as soon as you ask something about how they feel or ask them to relate to their pain, you're in the field of psychology. So we need to really embrace the fact that people have an experience of their pain, and that psychology is super important to consider, and that should be part of the way we when we interact with people. That should be one of the primary areas that we should be addressing when we manage our pain patient, particularly the ones with recurrent pain. So I completely forgot your question. I got on a tangent.
What are some of the ways that we convey it to our patients and maybe our community members, our primary care doctors, orthos about maintenance care, what that actually means?
Because that's one of the biggest knocks on chiropractic care right now. You know, that's what we all hear.
So it's about that. It's about psychological distress, and it's about managing, helping people manage pain over time. I think that's where maintenance care is pointing in this very right now. There are certain fields we haven't addressed yet, like sports performance. Can we affect that? Can we affect muscle function, coordination, strength, etc.? We haven't looked at that, and that's another field that might be something altogether different. But when it comes to what we have looked at, it's about managing recurrent pain, and that you shouldn't be afraid of assessing psychological variables with your patients.
Beautiful. Love that. Well, Dr. Eklund, if people are interested in your work, number one, where can they find you? If they want to interact with you, where can they find you? And how can people get a hold of you?
Well, they can. All the research that we've done is open access. That's one of the priorities we have. Everything we publish should be available for everyone to read and to use. So all the information out there is open access. You can find it on my profile at KI. So Andreas Eklund and KI, and then you can find my profile page, and then there's information there. You can email me if you have any questions, andreas.eklund@ki.se. Punkt is dot in Swedish, sorry.
Yeah. I'll link it in the show notes too. So
yeah. So you can email me. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have with regarding to this.
Beautiful. And you're on Twitter. Don't forget that.
Yeah, that's right.
No Twitter fights lately, but yeah. Well, you're on there, so
I'm not very vocal on Twitter or X as it's now called, but I do have an account, yeah.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Eklund, thank you so much for your contribution to the profession and for continuing to push forward. We so appreciate the more chiropractic researchers we're coming across, the more they still love clinical practice and they still love manual therapy and they still love the fact that they're chiropractors. And we definitely share that opinion with you. And we're just thankful that you're in this profession with us.
And thank you for being a voice of reason and on a very difficult topic.
Yeah.
You know, exactly.
Thank you.
That's
thank
very
you.
Noble of thank- you. Yeah.
Thank you for having me. This has been lovely. Thank
Beautiful.
You so much.
Well, we'll do it again. And I know that you come to Park every once in a while. We'll have to hook you up and we'll do it in person and maybe drink some wine.
Oh, absolutely. That would be lovely.
Awesome.
Absolutely.
All right, Dr. Eklund. Thank you so much, guys. And good luck with patients. All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Gestalt Education Show. If you liked it, share it, subscribe to it, send it to your friends, send it to someone that needs to hear this message. We really want everyone to be able to tune in and get the best clinical advice that they can, which we're hoping that we're giving to you with these special guests. So if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to us, or if you have any suggestions on upcoming conversations, let us know. For a list of our upcoming courses, we're adding them all the dang time. So go to gestaltedu.com, click on courses, and they'll all be right there for you. All right, have a good day.